Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review with Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever they're interested in listening to it, which is, you know, when they download it and have time to listen to it. Today we have a really neat show, an eclectic show. We've got Karen Roberts joining us again from Hall & Render, which is a defense-oriented law firm in Indianapolis. Keith Altman from Finkelstein & Partners, which is a national plaintiff law firm based in Newburgh, New York. And Conrad Jacoby, founder of Efficient EDD and a former outside lawyer based in Washington, D.C. They're all joining us on the show to talk about how to deal with databases and the electronically stored information in databases and e-discovery. This is an area with a good deal of complexity, but database information can often reveal a substantial amount of information in a case. How to get to that information can be fairly complex, and I think this is going to be an interesting show. So, because we've got both sides of the equation, plaintiff and defense, on the show. Each of the speakers, let me go into a little detail about them. Karen Roberts has over a dozen years of electronic discovery and litigation experience at law firms and in-house legal departments. She's currently a litigation support specialist at Hall & Render, Killian, Heath & Lyman in Indianapolis, Indiana. She's responsible for coordinating all litigation support technology services for the firm, including in-house processing and production of electronic discovery. She also provides consultation on electronic records management and electronic evidence handling. Prior to joining Hall & Render, Karen was the corporate electronic discovery coordinator for Eli Lilly and Company, developing records management, electronic discovery best practices, as well as managing large-scale electronic discovery projects. She's frequent speaker and active in the litigation support industry through her memberships of the Sedona Conference Working Groups on Electronic Document Retention and Production, International Legal Technology Association, and also the Association of Litigation Support Professionals, and lastly, Women in eDiscovery. We also did a really nice podcast on reviewing hospital records a few months ago with ESI Bytes. Keith Altman is an attorney with Finkelstein & Partners in their mass tort department and specializes in pharmaceutical litigation. After consulting on several major pharmaceutical litigations since 1996, Keith was admitted to the Bar of California in 2008. Some of the litigations he's worked on include diet drugs, Resulin, Propulsid, Accutane, Lariam, hormone therapy, Neurontin, Lyrica, Envandia, Meridia, Viagra, and Ortho Evra. Keith's also an expert in electronic discovery. He's the founder of the American Association of Justice Electronic Discovery Litigation Group. He's also a member of Working Group 1 of the Sedona Conference on Electronic Discovery and is a member of several drafting teams. He's lectured throughout the United States on electronic discovery issues. He has a BS, and you're the first astrophysics BS recipient that's ever done an ESI Bytes show. And, he's done extensive software development for data analysis and litigation support tools. Conrad Jacoby, the final panelist, is the founder of Efficient EDD. He's an attorney and a consultant. His practice focuses on technology and its intersection with the law. He was a technologist like Keith before entering the practice of law. Conrad's broad knowledge of computer operations gives him both vocabulary and substantive knowledge to effectively communicate with both technical and legal professionals, ensuring that the important nuances are properly conveyed in both directions. Over the course of his legal career, he's assisted pharmaceutical and semiconductor manufacturers, petroleum companies, and engineers, and several internet-based companies with transactional intellectual property and litigation matters. Conrad's active in the legal community, serving as the founding chair of the eDiscovery Committee of the District of Columbia Bar Association Litigation Section, chair of the D.C. Bar's Listserv and Electronic Communications Task Force, and is a member of the Defense Research Institute's Technology Committee. He's also served on the editorial board of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production. Conrad's a frequent speaker in e-discovery litigation support and information management topics. He lectures both in the U.S. and abroad on topics concerning information management and technology. He's also written numerous articles in national publications, including Law Technology News, LJN, e-discovery Law and Strategy, for the defense, and online at law.com and LLRX.com, where he contributes a monthly e-discovery update. Whew, that was a podcast in and of itself. Well, what's unique about the show is we've got both plaintiff and defense oriented experts. And the last time I tried the show, I did something like this called David versus Goliath. We almost had a virtual fight between defense oriented Kevin Esposito and plaintiff oriented Tom French. But since then, we've had the Sedona Conference's collaboration proclamation, and Karen and Conrad have both agreed with Keith to work together on this and disagree respectfully and with civility. And I might add, David versus Goliath was an excellent show, so I'm very happy to have both sides on this. So briefly, starting first with Karen and then Keith and Conrad, how did each of you get interested in e-discovery?
Well, it was a little over a decade ago. It seems like much longer than that, but it was 10, 11 years ago, and I was working at a law firm, and we were national counsel for a pharmaceutical company that was served with a class action lawsuit, products liability, and the discovery we needed to do from that company involved group-wise email. And anybody who's worked for a time in e-discovery knows that there's some significant differences in email platforms and how you might go about doing electronic discovery from it. But certainly 10 years ago, we didn't have the benefit of what we know today, and we did some things that by today's standards wouldn't fly, even by the most novice of judges. So, well, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. You do what you need to do to get the job done. But that's how I started in electronic discovery.
It's very iterative is the word everyone uses these days, and I think the whole history of learning has been that way. So, okay, Keith?
Well, I had begun my career working in sales and kind of at the birth of imaging systems, and then probably in about 1996, I got called into a meeting by somebody who said, hey, we heard in this pharmaceutical case, these guys have a database of all the adverse events. Can you help us, you know, formulate an argument to get that data? And so I did, and the judge granted it, and then they came back to me and they said, well, we got this data. We have no idea what to do with it. And so they gave it to me, and I started messing around with it. And ever since then, that's kind of the start, and I've been doing that for more or less for the last 12 years. I've been working with data and database information since I was, you know, probably for the last 25 years. So that's really the birth.
And Conrad.
Well, I think like everybody else, you don't start out intending to go into electronic discovery. It's something that sort of happens to you. I worked my way through college working in IT-related positions, and when I got out of law school and then started work as a young associate, it just so happened that I was assigned to a small piece of a very large piece of longstanding litigation where the key information was stored on IBM mainframe data tapes. And since I was the only person in the entire law firm who could pretty much, you know, even knew what these pancake-shaped things were, it became, even as a junior associate, I was the one in charge of drafting discovery for this material, figuring out what it would take both to retrieve this material for the opposing party and for us to make use of it, and to argue that motion. So at the time, it wasn't called electronic discovery, but once we sort of worked through those issues, which took quite a lot of time in those days, it's just something that's been coming up more and more frequently until it really became a key component of my practice and now my consulting practice.
Let's talk now substantively about databases. Conrad, and if any of the others want to join in, what areas of law do databases appear most frequently in e-discovery litigation?
Well, I think that that's a bit of a moving target. And the answer is that it's appearing in more and more places and more ways that you may or may not expect. From my perspective, one of the ways it came up first is that any type of manufacturing, any type of institution where widgets are being created or counted, that information has not, for years and years and years, has been tracked through databases. And by obvious extension, when you take widgets and abstract that to money, almost all of our financial systems are today run, and transactional systems are run through databases and not through documents anymore. So document discovery in those instances is actually finding reports or summaries taken from much larger data repositories. So we have, on one hand, we have a tremendous amount of information in the financials and manufacturing. We also see it certainly in the medical field and the pharmaceutical litigation, where we have, again, both the manufacturing information being fed into databases, but then we also have adverse events and complex factual analyses being tracked not by documents, but by databases, where trends can be collated and extrapolated very quickly. And then also in medical records today, just a few weeks ago, I was talking with someone who is the chief knowledge officer for a hospital, who was bemoaning the end of documents, and that even in active treatment, people are feeding information, physicians and nurses are feeding all of their information into databases. So when people ask for a copy of their medical records, even that's becoming a challenge, because there is no file with your medical records anymore. It's all just a series of database entries. So I see tremendous amounts of things. I think HR is the next area where we're going to see an end of traditional personnel files, and more of that information is going to be stored in structured data. It's something that continues to evolve and is evolving very quickly, I think.
Right.
This is Keith. One thing I'd like to add is one of the biggest advents of databases, something that had not been able to be done, and this is why you see it exploding everywhere. Traditional paper documents were managed. You put them in filing cabinets, and maybe you sorted them by name. But if you also needed to find them sorted by date, you couldn't do that unless you kept a separate copy of the files. And if you needed to sort it by Social Security number, you couldn't do that as well. And the fact that you can put these kinds of – you can manage those kinds of information in a database, which can allow you to sort them based on any of those criteria, any criteria you decide, has really expanded the use of databases into almost the most mundane of situations. So it's literally pervasive everywhere. And the concept of what is a database, Conrad and I would debate this with others all the time. What does a database mean anymore? It's definitely a moving target.
Well, and actually, if I can follow up from Keith, one of the biggest databases that all of us use without ever thinking about it is our email systems. When you think about it, yes, we think of in our minds perhaps an email message is the digital equivalent of a letter that's been sent to us and has a little digital stamp on it. In reality, if you think about a Microsoft Exchange server or a GroupY server or any server, there are no discrete messages on these servers anymore. It's a giant database where messages are literally reconstructed on the fly and then sent down for users to read. So even in things that we just assume are documents, because all of us are still very much are just much more comfortable thinking about things in terms of documents. Databases are really just everywhere. And some of the issues with email production we've been able to work through because it's a very specific type of container. Other issues continue, these issues that we're going to be discussing come up in the email context, and they come up in many other contexts as well.
Keith, you started to talk a little bit about the differences of the types of information you can find in databases. But is there anything else you want to elaborate other than the sorting of the different types of information you can find that are useful to a case on a database that you can't find elsewhere?
Well, it's not, let's look at its lowest level. I mean, there are, take a document management system of some kind. Yes, you can in principle find the documents. They could be sitting in the filing cabinets. They can be sitting as PDF files or TIFF files on a disk. But it's the management of those materials that really sets things apart. So, what you can find in databases is a whole host of categorizations of the information. And then more importantly is the ability to see trends, patterns. I spend a lot of my time doing what I call signal detection, anomaly detection, looking for something that's different or changed. We all inherently, intuitively do these kinds of things. We may not call it signal detection. We may not have a specific methodology of how we do it, but we all kind of do it, and that's what you can do with the databases that you can't do any other way. And that's where the production format, how a database is produced, can literally take away your ability to do those kinds of signal detections if they're not produced in a way that's conducive to that. For example, taking a database and printing it out to TIFF images. That effectively destroys a database for what it is. Yes, you get the raw information, but you lose the spirit of the information when you do that.
So it's almost metadata on steroids here.
That's not an unreasonable analogy.
Okay. Karen, from a defendant's perspective, are databases and e-discovery truly scary stuff and worse than email?
Well, I think, you know, for databases, it's understood that you would have a database because you have a lot of information to manage, and having that much information to manage requires having more sophisticated tools to get at it. While I agree with the previous point Conrad made about email systems being basically databases, that's true. But what I see in some of these larger systems inside the companies is the complexity, the relational operations of the databases, which mean there's various tables of information that work together. And when it comes time to meet and confer about certain systems, it's difficult with these large databases to be able, number one, to ascertain how much data there is in that system that is potentially responsive. Many of these systems are built around business processes, and as we know, electronic discovery needs and requirements are a vast departure from what the system was originally built for. So taking a financial system, for instance, is built to track payments and receivables, and when electronic discovery comes in, we're looking for maybe certain payments to certain entities. We can probably do that within the system as it's built, but if we're getting some more complex discovery requests and trying to ascertain the volume of that data, and then taking it a step further as to how would we possibly produce this to the other side. The point of having all this information in a database is, again, the ability to search it, manipulate it, report on it, sort it based on multiple criteria, and again, to Keith's point, doing a flat type output in a PDF or a report takes that usability aspect out from an e-discovery standpoint. And oftentimes the other side isn't happy with that. There's so much data to manage and search across, they want it in a format that they can manipulate and work with. And from a defense standpoint, that's putting a lot of trust in the other side that that information isn't going to be manipulated in a different fashion or in a fashion that casts a different light on the information than how it would appear in the system. So it can be scary from the standpoint of we know so little or have so little experience with the best way to provide that in an e-discovery forum that balances both usability and retrievability, but also doesn't present an undue burden in getting to that point.
Hmm. And those were some hard issues you raised there, and that's why we have the panel to see if we can answer these. Maybe not. but anyway, Keith, you're looking at this from a different perspective. I mean, Karen's obviously concerned with handing over her entire system for you to play with. What's your perspective on this with databases?
Well, two things I say. In light of what Karen just said, very often I will suggest that letters start with, in the spirit of minimizing your burden but preserving the usability of the information, we suggest the following. So it's very much along those lines. Databases are a funny kind of thing. There isn't a lot of mystery of how you produce a paper document. There isn't a lot of mystery of how you produce conventional electronic documents such as a Word file or the actual text of an email. But there's so much variability in how a database can be produced that you really unilateral demands and unilateral decisions in terms of production just don't work. And there is the desire on the part of the requesting party to maybe look at the information in a different way than the producing party did in the routine course of business. And just because the producing party didn't see the info, didn't run that kind of analysis or run that kind of report, does not make it invalid for the requesting party to do so. And maybe there's the argument that they should have done that kind of, look at the data. So from the plaintiff's perspective, there is often a reluctance on the part of the producing parties to be a little bit more objective in looking beyond how the data was used. I always try to give people a guideline. I'll accept the data in a format that allows me with a reasonable amount of effort to do effectively with the information what the producing party could have done itself, whether through its application or through somebody executing some ad hoc queries. If you give it to me in that format, that's good enough, which means, you know, it may, for an Oracle database, maybe that's an Oracle unload file, or maybe it's a Microsoft Access database, or maybe it's comma delimited text files. You know, I have to load the comma delimited text files, but that's not a lot of effort for me to do that and put that into my own database, in a format that is workable. So that's really the guideline, and that's pretty much the plaintiff's perspective. And I hate to use the term plaintiff's perspective because I think you're starting to, in Sedona, we try to move away from plaintiff and defendant and really focus on requesting party and and producing party, because you're going to start seeing, you know, databases coming from, you know, plaintiff's home computers. In a personal injury litigation, you might have a database on their computer that they created themselves. So I think we need to move away from that concept because it's a two-way street.
Yeah, Conrad here, if I can just add a point, I think one of the things, so much of what we'll be talking about today are sort of big ticket, big system databases. But it's also important that what's included in here are desktop access databases, or even in some cases where some folks are starting to request information that in some cases may have been created initially by a law firm. We're talking about things like potentially concordance and summation databases. There are a bunch of platforms. We're not just talking about Big Iron. We're also talking about a lot of smaller tools. And because of the diversity of information, I think one of the reasons that databases are viewed as scary, it's just like the dawn of the e-discovery age. We don't have very many lawyers presently in the bar who are adequately educated and comfortable asking the right kinds of questions and focusing and willing to step up and say, here are the things I think I need to work through. And because of that lack of education, we have a lack of confidence, which leads to a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And I think to some extent a lot of the less than complete discussions that at the start of a matter that lead to problems down the road.
I'll add to that before I ask the next question that I've wanted to do this podcast for a while, and I was having a hard time finding panelists among e-discovery experts.
We've all been busy doing our discovery on various databases.
There's some of that too. But anyway, now let's talk through sort of the process. Case starts, you got to preserve your data, put your litigation hold in place. Conrad, how do you preserve your databases?
Well, the number one thing that I would say that not enough people, not enough legal teams are doing, and Keith would certainly agree with me, is you have to figure out what on earth you have. You have to talk to not only the people with system with substantive knowledge of the kinds of information that may be stored in a database, because that's how you figure out that that a specific database or series of databases may be relevant. You then need to talk to the database managers. Databases come in many different flavors. You know, my favorite kind, and it's been the kind that I've most often had to deal with, are the idea that they are the final repositories of corporate information. And so the databases are constantly being added to, but you don't necessarily have a deletion. You don't necessarily have a destruction of information problem on these systems. And when you're in a situation like that, the challenge actually becomes perhaps more having a conversation with the requesting party about when can I stop giving you information? What is the cutoff point? Because litigation typically involves actions that have happened in the past. So the most current information being put in your system often, I'm not going to say always, often isn't relevant to the particular lawsuit. So in those systems, preservation can simply be a matter of the producing party has sufficient comfort that material is not being rolled off of the database, you can say, we will work with our live database, and you don't have to worry about backup tapes. You don't have to worry about a lot of the complicated, expensive to work with materials. On the other hand, there are also a lot of transactional systems where think of a point of sale. When you buy something at a store, the cash register today is almost certainly a computer terminal that's writing things back to some kind of centralized database. And those databases get purged on a regular basis after transactions have cleared, perhaps every 30 days, every 60 days. You don't know. And it's the fact that you don't know that means you immediately, when you realize that one of these systems may be implicated, you need to talk to the managers to see what the system is. They can't. Most of these systems have so much information flowing through them that you can't just say, well, just stop deleting things. You'll grind the entire system down to a halt. On the other hand, it may be possible, because these systems have to have so much redundancy in them, that you may be able to intercept a backup that's already been made in the regular course of business. Perhaps you might be able to schedule a regular backup of the database. But that can run into some difficulties, because usually, or often is probably a better way of putting it, only a small section of the actual information, of the total information in a database, is relevant to a given dispute. Keith certainly has worked with this quite a bit. There are very few instances where 100% of a database is relevant to a litigation matter of a large database. And so one of the challenges in preserving things when you do have data rolling off is how much of this do I need to preserve? Is there a way to take a slice of data that's being rolled off of just the data that's really at issue? And how do I do that in a way that, fine, I have it preserved, but now it's extremely expensive to bring it back? And I think we work through these things on a case-by-case basis.
Do you want to document all these steps you're taking? Because it would seem to me that you're more than likely going to make mistakes along the way, given the complexity of how databases operate, some, you know, losing data and some maintaining it forever.
Well, I think it's very important to have documentation, because I think telling the story is a critical part of this. It's telling the story to the requesting party. It's telling the story to the court. And when you look at the big, tremendously exciting and scary sanctions cases that have rolled down over the last couple of years, it's because the attorneys in court have not been completely candid, either because they haven't, most likely because they haven't known the full story of electronic data. And when things get lost in translation, we get into a lot of trouble very, very quickly. So documenting this may mean that you may want to bring in, for example, an outside expert who can say, these are the people I talked to. This is the factual information they gave me. And because of this, the legal team made a legal judgment that preservation was adequate. Or based on this factual information, the legal team decided that additional steps were required for preservation. Hopefully you never go there, but right now, where things are so unsettled, it's certainly it's an extremely important insurance policy to have.
Keith, I'm going to use the P word again as plaintiff. Sometimes you've got to start preserving before there's litigation just because you think it's impending, based on the facts of the situation. But oftentimes it'll start when the plaintiff contacts you. You're contacting and you're asking for information in a lot of your cases. Is there an art for asking for database material if you don't know much about the defendant's systems?
It's very difficult to do so. Starting from where Conrad left off, it's very important early in the process to talk with the requesting party. That can have a big impact on preservation. There was a time where people were all up in arms about backup tapes, getting stuff off of backup tapes. And I can tell you that while they do need to be preserved rationally, very rarely do you have to go to the backup tapes. And a lot of the concern was because they never asked the requesting parties whether they really needed to go to the backup tapes right away. Now, of course, there are parties who claim that they do, but as a general proposition, it's not the first place you look. Same thing comes along with preservation. You need to ask the requesting party what it is that they're looking for, because you may find that what it is that they're looking for can substantially simplify your preservation efforts. But in terms of asking for information, one would hope there is a rhyme and a reason to the way most businesses operate. And so you would hope that you have some general intuitive understanding of the kinds of information that a business might be maintaining, and you start with that. But it's very difficult to provide focused, tailored requests when you don't know what the other side has. And that's part of the initiative under Sedona, is to have early communications between the parties to identify relevant information to help filter and tailor requests, to help minimize the burden, but still, once again, preserve the utility of the information. Now, sometimes you have general experience because you've dealt with that particular party in the past, and you say, I want this database because you know they have it, you've worked with it, and hopefully they can take advantage of what they've done in the past, or it's an industry that you have a lot of experience with, as I do with the pharmaceutical industry, or, you know, where there's a certain regulatory or statutory requirement to do certain things, and you'll know that they'll have certain information associated with that. But once again, it's difficult, and we go out there and we hope that the other side can tell me what I need to know so I can cut down things that we ask for, so that we could say we don't need certain databases or certain tables or certain kinds of information.
Let's talk about...
And this is Karen. I just wanted to chime in here from the big D side, from the defense side, that, you know, litigation preparedness is, you know, cannot be emphasized enough in this context, that the obligation is on the defense to come to the table at the 26F with that list of here's the type of data that you're going to want and the system that it's in. I think there's varying shades of comfort and risk tolerance about how much information is included in that at that point in time. But I think, you know, for large businesses that deal with a lot of litigation, and again, Keith and I come from pharmaceutical experience, we know that in products liability, there's certain key systems where the data lives, and that's what the other side's going to ask for. That's not a secret, and that's not a strategy per se. But I think, again, getting to the point of saying they're going to want this type of data, so let's go in and tell them what we have, what we can do, and what we're not going to do, because some of these systems are so complex and are so deep and do take a lot of extra resources to manipulate, export, or somehow search for data in these large systems. That's part of what companies need to look at in their litigation preparedness plan, is analyzing those systems before the litigation hits, if that's possible, but at least identifying where the data lives in their organization and coming up with some ideas about how they might go about identifying and disclosing to the other side what those systems and how they operate and things along those lines.
Karen, you were moving into my next question, which is good. How do you review the database data before you make it available to the other side? So it sounds like you got to do some work before the 26F, obviously. Are you running a bunch of queries and trying to figure things out, interviewing people?
Sure. And my tactic has always been, or in my experience, I've found there's usually a meeting with two key players related to that system. The first would be the IT support personnel, whoever that is, if there's a database analyst or subject matter expert, or even if it's an outsourced application and you have a third-party vendor you're dealing with. You need to get somebody at the table that knows, if I hit this button, what am I going to get? If I need to get this type of an output, is that possible? How is the data organized? What's the backup rotation? What's the automatic data purge cycle? Those are all very important questions that you need answers to from a defense standpoint, to be able to go back to the other side and say, here's what we're going to do, here's what we're not going to do, here's where there's burden, here's where we can get you this quickly, but it might not be in the exact format that you want. You need to take the initiative and learn that from a technical aspect, what the system and how it runs and how proprietary and how customized or configured it is in your particular environment. But then the other side of that is not just the technical aspect, but the business side. So there's always a business owner related to a system that may or may not be the right person for that conversation, but certainly a place to start. There's subject matter experts that work with the system day in and day out, and they know the type of data that's in the system and the best way to go about retrieving it. So if you have those two players or representatives from those two camps at the table, you'll get the information that you need to, number one, gain access to that system and start looking at, okay, if the other side's asking for this, how would I go about doing that? Is it possible? And what type of output might I be able to expect from that? And a lot of these systems have data that is tracked in the system, but maybe isn't necessarily available in an output format. And again, that's information that's critical to know. And sitting down with those folks and getting some hands-on experience with the system will answer a lot of those questions. So yeah, it really very much does start with an interview process.
So Keith, you sit down with Karen on the other side, okay, and she's done her work. She's interviewed the business and the IT people. She's presenting you with what they have. You had mentioned earlier that you like to get your databases in a form that you can manipulate it, say an Oracle load file. You can't always get with a customized database a load file that you can manipulate. How do you review databases, both from ones that you can manipulate and ones that you can't?
Well, in terms of the concept of not being able to manipulate a database, I don't agree with that proposition. I don't believe that there is a database out there that cannot be manipulated. The question is, and this is what's important in that interaction, what are the burden points of getting the data? There's really two issues, and you got to separate the problem up. What is the burden of getting it into a candidate production that can be reviewed for responsiveness and privilege and things along those nature, and then what is the burden of reviewing, doing that review? What's important is to determine where the burden points are, because one of the things I found with databases is that sometimes a very slight alteration to the request can have a tremendous impact on the burden in terms of reducing burden, but yet not really take away from the usability of the information. And so the better the information is from the producing party and where the burden points really are, the better the requesting party can tailor the request, saying, you know what, maybe I can live without that particular piece of information. It isn't worth the effort that goes into that. Or maybe you're telling me that you're preserving it and we can come back to it another day after we get the first data production. We can see, do we really need that information? I can't make that determination right now. But in terms of, you know, when I say I like to get in a format, I'm flexible. If I'll take it in whatever the, you know, as long as I, once again, the reasonable effort to take it in, if they want to give it to me Oracle Unload, fine. They want to give me ASCII, fine. I don't have any particular demands, shall we say, of the format other than I can work with it with a reasonable amount of effort. And so whatever's easier, and once again, that comes from, you know, communication with the communication for the parties. A lot of times it's a SQL database, and the simplest way to produce the information is in the table format in which it's kept in the routine course of business. That's not true for all databases, but it's true for some databases. I'll take it that way. You don't have to make my custom reports to me. I'm not expecting you to analyze the data for me. I'll do all of that myself, as long as you give me the information in a reasonable format in which I could do it. So, you know, I think that there has to be that communication there.
And you were talking there about the form of production. I don't know if Conrad or Karen, if either of you have any other thoughts on that.
I have one thing I'd like to say, and it's something that that comes up a great deal, and it's a vocabulary issue that, especially in dealing with structured data and databases, just really muddles the issue. And that is the idea that many requests for electronically stored information today specify that material must be produced in its native format. And that idea is that when I want to look at a Microsoft Word document, I want to make sure that my metadata is intact and that I can see it in the way it was kept in the ordinary course of business. And I think from you know, as Keith has put it, for a variety of technological reasons, a native format production of a database is almost never feasible, either because the database is too large or contains too much information that is not relevant to the dispute. And what we're really talking about is we're talking about production in a reasonably usable format. And that may be an electronic format. It may be a searchable format. There are lots of different adjectives we can use. But I think a real takeaway point is to say you don't ask for a database in its native format, because that's really not a helpful way of articulating the request. And indeed, if someone dumps tens of thousands of data tables on you, that may be a great deal more burdensome than finding a way that you can extract the data and have it produced to you in a reduced number of tables or as an access database or something, some other format that is not exactly as it was stored in the ordinary course of business.
And I would add that the proprietary nature of some of these systems, these large data management systems, again, may not be a SQL backend or an Oracle backend. It might be a commercial off-the-shelf application that's purchased that requires a great deal of hardware and software licensing just to run the data in the, quote, native format. So native format isn't always the way to go, per se, but I think, again, having the conversation at the front end and understanding what the purpose is behind getting the data. If the purpose of getting the data is being able to query it and manipulate it and report on it themselves, then certainly they need it in a format where the data is closer to native than it is to, say, paper or static reports. So, again, it needs to be taken in context of the litigation and the discovery request, the ultimate need that's required. Certainly, if the database is so proprietary that there is no possible way to output that information in a format that would be usable by the other side, then we need to get creative with either having an on-site visit and segregating data and saying, here's a terminal and here's an IT professional that can help you look at this, perhaps doing some sampling, getting an idea of what information is contained in that system before getting to what will ultimately be the production format.
And I think one thing that's very important, and I think the panelists will all agree, to two things I'm going to say here. Number one, it's the proceeds of discovery that should be the weapon and not the process. This should not be about being abusive or being obstructive. Number two, the days of a requesting party saying, I want it all because I want it, and the producing party say, I don't wanna, are over. The producing party has got to come to the table willing to articulate what they need and why they need it, because frankly, if they're not willing to do that with the other side, then certainly how could they do that in a motion to compel in front of the court? This is not generally state secret stuff. On the other side of the coin, if you want to run to the judge and say this is unreasonably burdensome because it's not reasonably accessible, you better be prepared to articulate that. So why not articulate that in the 26F conference when people are sitting down and providing the information? That's a, let's call it a maturity of the parties with respect to this kind of information that really needs to grow and frankly hasn't been adequately developed at this point. And I think everything we've said to this point is pointing to the exact same situation the parties have got to communicate.
Keith, you already were talking about deciding on the review. A lot of it's based on the costs of the resources you're going to have to throw at it, the burden, which is sort of a way of restating proportionality on whether it's worth the effort. Conrad, from that, with that as sort of a an understanding that that's an issue that's out there, do defendants have to be prepared to argue against production based on cost issues, and how do you do that?
Well, I think proportionality is an extremely important component in electronic discovery because it's a component of discovery. A producing party has always had the ability to push back against a request for information or a request for documents from a litigant saying, look, we don't think this information we think this is a phishing expedition. We don't think there's anything meaningfully relevant, substantively relevant to the material. It would cost us X dollars to get at it, and we don't think we should have to do that. And for years and years in paper-based discovery, judges have listened to such arguments, and they have found that they have figured out solutions that satisfy somebody or certainly satisfy justice. And I think those same principles are very applicable here in electronic discovery and particularly in the discovery of databases. But as you just suggested, to make those arguments, you can't just come in waving your hands and saying, we just think this is too burdensome. need to come in and articulate intelligently what the burdens are. And doing so educates a judge as to both as to the substance of the case, and it also educates the judge that you are taking these issues seriously, and to the extent that maybe there is a hole or something or some piece of information that you haven't been able to obtain in advance, that you're likely to go and hunt it down the moment you understand there's a need for that information. So I think it's important to be extremely prepared to talk about not necessarily cost, but burden in the larger scheme. One of the things that is coming up, and the legal community is really not equipped to deal with it, is the concept of cloud computing. And when you start seeing databases in the cloud, which are being used, one of the things you have is that you, the producing party, may not have the same degree of access, back-end access to a database that you would have if you hosted the data internally. So even though this outsourced database is providing exactly the same functionality, you can't go in as an administrator and pull raw data in the way you could when you had it in-house. Being able to go in and articulate these issues with a requesting party and an open court is just key to making people understand what you can and cannot do and finding a reasonable accommodation.
That's a funny observation on cloud computing. I joke with clients or potential clients that I believe that the project management issue of e-discovery, the answers are in the cloud, but I'm not prepared to try to convince people and sell them on project management in the cloud, but I'm also trying to convince them the concept search engines are useful tool, because I'd be out of business if I tried to package those two.
You might have to change your marketing tactic there, Carl.
but anyway, the other thing I want to mention on proportionality, just a little alert. I'm doing a podcast coming up, if you think this is an interesting area, with Jonathan Redgrave and Judge Rosenbaum in a couple of weeks, just on proportionality. So anyway, back into the topic. Karen, you had talked a little earlier about what happens if it's unfeasible to produce the database and maybe have the other side peek at the database and maybe collaborate and talk about what you can provide. Is there anything else you'd want to add if you thought it was too inaccessible or costly to produce?
Well, again, I think it goes back to, in context of the litigation and the discovery request, how important it is. And balancing that, again, just it's the whole proportionality discussion about how important is this information and getting it. So if you are in a position where you have a critical business application that has information key to the litigation that the other side needs, then by all means, the producing party needs to open up their doors and create an environment where they can share some of their resources if it is indeed that inaccessible. But I think Keith's point is not lost here, in that talking about it is important, being upfront and honest about it. But again, we see still a lack of education and a lack of experience and knowledge with counsel in this area, that we're still dealing with discovery about discovery and not focusing on the true issues of the case. So my hope is that this will start to turn around sooner. But I think in the Baycall litigation that was some years ago was one of the first instances where there was some, let's open the doors and let somebody come and sit at a terminal and just run wild on the system. The system was so large and was so burdensome, there was just no other way to get that data in the hands of the other side but for going that route. So I think talking about sampling and talking about having on-site visits is probably going to come up more in the future.
And you know, with the on-site visits, what's, you know, even a less pleasant experience for a producing party is a forced on-site visit because of lack of information. There have been several occasions where databases have been produced, representations have been made that turned out not to be true or not to be accurate. And the end result was where I or others have been ordered access into the producing party's facility to review the information. It's not a particularly, it's not an experience I enjoy. It's clearly very stressful for the producing parties, very stressful for the requesting party, and frankly, it didn't have to happen if there was communication between the parties. So there was no reason for it up front, and I think that's where it's all going.
This podcast goes at the educational aspect of helping to give more people some expertise or understanding of the issues, but you raise an interesting point, Keith, where maybe you have more knowledge of e-discovery than your adversary, and that can be just an e-discovery in general. It happens all the time, or in this area of databases even more specifically. How do you work through these issues when you know more than the other side? I mean, how do you coach?
I've been always very willing to assist when there's a database that I want and the other side perceives that there's a difficulty. I've always been willing to spend whatever time is necessary to try to assist the other technical people to work through the problems. I think I'm a little bit different than most of the lawyers out there, because not only am I out there requesting the stuff, I'm the guy that's actually crunching the data. So I when I go out there and I'm asking for a database, I pretty much have a good idea of what the burden is and what the problems are. And, you know, sometimes there's pushback and not wanting assistance, and I can kind of understand that. But on the other hand, that makes for much less efficient discovery, and you know, a requesting party needs to be willing to share how to get that information effectively. It's not a state secret. I mean, I think it goes the other way as well, where you have a producing party that's more sophisticated than the requesting party. I think there can be a transference the other way, where you can say, look, I understand that you say you want this entire database, but let me explain to you, you know, why don't we talk about what it is that you want, and let's sit down and let me explain to you how I could give it to you in such a way that you can do what it is that you think you want to do with it.
And that's an excellent point, Keith, that I've seen, you know, I've had experience where, well, that's what they asked for, that's what we're going to give them, and that's not the best, I think, position to take in that type of a situation. That, again, helping to educate the other side is just as important as managing your own position as far as electronic discovery of databases goes.
So you got to control the litigators in this process sometimes. moving ahead into an area that a lot of e-discovery people and especially technologists sometimes give advice about, you know, what to let in-house people do versus what not to. Conrad, is this an area where we don't want to let the in-house people attempt to preserve the email or unstructured ESI? Does that advice work for databases when they might be the only people with knowledge of how to work the database?
Well, I think it's essential that the in-house people have to be involved in whatever process a producing party comes up with. They're the only, as you just said, they're the only people who actually know what's going on in the system. And they're the only people who can advise you as to particular idiosyncrasies of a given database, including things like you can have a perfectly good-looking database, but fields have been repurposed over time. This is something that I know Keith and I have both worked with, where as a database, as accumulation of information gets stored up in a database, you may start using it more broadly, and that means that you may start repurposing certain fields. Well, in the database, you can't tell, but it's the keepers of the database may be able to give you some information. So I think it's very important that you have to have them involved. And secondly, one of the reasons that we traditionally, you know, have recommended that outsiders, you know, that third parties get involved for data collection is to preserve authenticity and have retraceable steps. And one of the things about with structured data is with a good conversation, you can establish what the information is, you can talk about the process, and the fact that you're not creating a cloned carbon copy of a Word file, that you're extracting data in some form, some subset of data, and producing it. There are ways that you can, in a productive conversation with a requesting party, reach agreement as to perhaps authenticity or accuracy that negate the need or reduce the need to have third parties involved. On the other hand, one of the things that's been my experience is that pretty much every IT guy I've ever worked with in a corporate setting has a full-time job. IT is staffed very, very leanly. And when you ask them to do something in addition to their existing full-time job, one of two things happens, perhaps one of three things. The nicest thing is that they actually will work the extra overtime and work with you as much as possible and get you what you need, and that doesn't happen very often. The second thing that will happen is they will get you something in their free time, which unfortunately is rarely the same timetable that the legal team needs. And the third is they may say, look, we just don't have the resources to deal with this. We need to bring in a specialist. We'll work with somebody who can just deal with this. We have our own things to do because we need to keep the business running. And a legal team simply won't know the answers to those questions without talking with the in-house people and getting their perspective and understanding where they're coming from. So I think getting them involved is incredibly important and valuable and doesn't create the same spoliation risks that we associate with in-house collection of other types of information from time to time. And, hopefully also with proper communication, we can get around some of those, we can just avoid some of those potential issues that have plagued things like email accuracy, email authenticity, and allegations of document manipulation.
Karen, let's talk a little bit about the confidentiality issue with some records, say hospital medical records, which are governed by HIPAA. Between you and Keith, can you suggest how eDiscovery can proceed when you've got confidential mixed in with the information that you want?
Well, again, I think that goes back to analyzing the source system and what flexibility you have in the output. The nice thing about, I think, of dealing with databases as opposed to unstructured documents, memos, emails, is that oftentimes that confidential information is in a specific field, and oftentimes you can just eliminate that field from the data export or from the form of production as opposed to, pushing out a whole table and then trying to figure out, well, which field is the Social Security number in and how do I get it out of there. If it's blended in with, other information, I've seen some systems where confidential information was within a text field. Text fields are the worst to deal with, I think, in structured data systems because you never know what you're going to find in there, and it, requires that much more stringent of a review. But then you get into a situation of, again, based on the format that you're producing, how is that information going to be redacted or somehow pulled out of the data? So, again, having that conversation with the other side, full disclosure, I think they realize that there's confidential information in there, and whether or not you have a confidentiality agreement negotiated ahead of time or there's an understanding, a disclosure and an understanding and agreement that certain fields won't be produced or that portions of fields data will be removed. Again, levels the playing field.
I think there are two concepts that go along with that, with the kinds of databases that Karen and I have dealt with. One is a classic example is an adverse event database. As a general part of my practice for a particular drug, we want the entire adverse event database for all events, not just the ones that may be the subject of the litigation. On the other hand, there are certain specific fields within a database like that are free text narrative fields. And in reality, the burden of extraction is the same whether you extract 10 records or 10,000 records. There really is very little different. But there's an enormous difference in the burden of reviewing that information for confidentiality. And these are, once again, fields that you can't just blank out the whole field. And what we've done is we've worked through a methodology, for example, where we have a list of terms for which we consider to be the primary terms. And for those terms, the producing party's just got to bite the bullet, and they've got to review the narratives for those particular terms. For the other terms that are considered are important but are considered secondary, they can completely redact the narratives and not have to do any review. Now, the net process there is that there's very little incremental burden between producing the entire database as the requesting party needs it and producing just a smaller subset of that that's the core information. I think that's very important. And once again, that comes from a good communication between the parties when you do that kind of thing. And that's happening more and more often.
You know, if we look into the future, one of the themes I think all three of you have been echoing, especially with the database issue, is how important collaboration is. Would you agree that that's probably the biggest theme that's going to happen with databases going forward into the future? And if you have any other theme that you want to throw in there.
Well, I think Conrad mentioned this earlier about the cloud computing and the SaaS is really sort of taking on a lot more in the marketplace than I think anybody could have predicted. I think we just have, you know, the downward turn in the economy has forced, you know, the economic pressures to look for some of these methods that save money, and cloud computing is one of those. So finding e-discovery solutions in that, you know, complicates e-discovery that much more. But again, just I see that becoming more of an issue. Conceptual search technology, you brought this up, Carl, that this, again, is more than just keyword searching, is I think starting to become more accepted and councils becoming more comfortable with the idea of using some of these advanced technologies, advanced analytics to help get at the data. And judges are getting up to speed on the learning curve. I think when we go into court, it's important not to try and hide the ball, because they're starting to notice that, hey, if you don't know about this stuff and you're representing your client, judges know enough now to spot that.
Okay, and Keith and Conrad?
Well, I think that you're going to see a movement towards bringing the true disputes to the court. And what I mean by that is a lot of the issues will be able to be worked out through, let's call it, good communication between the parties and clarification. And
you had an example, actually. I don't mean to interject, but I didn't want to ask it as a separate question. You want to go into that? We talked about that before the podcast.
Well, we had, you know, in fact, it was, I believe that Karen and I were on opposite ends of an issue. And there was an issue with a particular database that needed to be produced, and it was produced, and there was something with the data that did not allow, that fundamentally did not allow my side to be able to do the analyses that needed to be done. We had a discussion. It turned out that technologically it would have been very difficult to resolve the problem in a way that would have allowed the analysis, and the parties were able to engage in a stipulation that said that, look, this is the limitation on the data set, and we understand that, and we're willing to make this compromise in how, you know, and it was a date field that was in question, and we're willing to make this compromise on the date field, and we move forward with that. So this stuff really does happen, happen in the real world where we can resolve these things. But there will be times that there will fundamentally be a disagreement between the parties. But what I hope that happens, what I think has to happen, is that when the parties go into court, they are dealing with an actual dispute, and B, the parties are bringing the true basis of the dispute before the court, which often is not necessarily a technological issue. It's just simply a philosophical issue, you know. There will be those disagreements. Yes, what I want is burdensome, and you just simply think it's too much burden. At least if you go to the court with what the burden really is and I go to the court with why I really need it, then the court is in a position to weigh the burden, weigh the need, and make an educated decision. And too many e-discovery decisions are being made by the courts these days where the parties have really not educated the court adequately on that particular dispute for them to render a rational decision. And that has to change, and I think it will change, and I think, it once again, it'll come with this maturity of the parties communicating the issues properly and working through them together to resolve them.
Conrad, has anyone left anything for Conrad to say? going last on a wrap-up question.
It's a little tough, but I think one of the things that is important to say is that a lot of practitioners and commentators are throwing around the idea of cooperation and collaboration and to which a lot of litigators, in particular, are reacting with abject horror. You know, the idea of collaborating with the enemy, I mean, these are very powerfully charged words. And the takeaway that I think I'd like to suggest, if you've listened to the podcast this far, I think you'll see that what we're really, all of us, are in agreement about is the need for communication, which is a less charged and critically important component. And I think Keith, spoke very well about how communication helps tee up the issues that are genuine issues that cannot be resolved by the parties. I can think of many litigation matters in which I've been involved where fundamentally there was not going to be agreement between the parties regarding the scope of discovery on certain pieces. And collaboration was not going to be possible. What was possible was education, and education of the judge, education of the other side, and an attempt to whittle away the things on which there really was not that much of a dispute, so that we were left with an actual clear argument or disagreement that could be made in front of the courts. I think in federal court, thanks to really the efforts of the last 10 years, we're seeing significantly more sophistication among the federal court judges. And one of the things that's been exciting to me is seeing really over the last 2 to 3 years, some emerging sophistication in some state courts where judges are saying, you know, this is coming up in my divorce cases. This is coming up in my criminal docket. This is coming up in all kinds of things. I have to start educating myself as well. And I think when we start seeing a more uniformly educated judiciary, I think that's going to send a very powerful message to lawyers and to legal teams and to both corporate producing parties and requesting parties, that we just have to change the way that we have traditionally perhaps addressed these things, and we'll get there. So I am cautiously hopeful.
Not only do we not do as good of a job, there's a lot less litigation when it costs so much to work through the discovery issues. You know, a lot of clients opt out of litigating now because of that. So anyway, didn't mean to throw an answer out. I'm moderating, but I got views on this stuff too. Hey, and I'll throw out one last quick question here. And Conrad, since you were at the end of the last one, you know, if you think about this in the EDRM model, you do end up sometimes at a trial. Not everything settles. How do you illustrate database information? Actually, anyone can answer this. Is this PowerPoint stuff? Is this interviewing witnesses or you know, getting testimony from witnesses?
I mean, I'll take your first crack at it, and the answer is just like any other evidence, what is the story you're trying to tell? If you're trying to show that information, how information was entered into a system because you're thinking that information slipped through the cracks, I would go with interviews and talk about the workflow process. On the other hand, if you're going back to, as Keith has done in some of his work, talk about trends and talk about what the data themselves, basically put the data on the stand, you're doing that through charts, you're doing that through summaries, perhaps you're doing it through raw data, but typically the amount of data involved is far too much that you'd ever want to show the jury, so you're dealing with some type of reasonable and accurate summary or interpretation of the data. So the trial consultants with whom I've worked love this kind of stuff because it lets them use their imagination of ways to summarize and tell those stories through graphics and through various innovative ways to attract and hold the jury's interest.
This is Keith. You know, along those lines, I do deal a lot with one of the fundamental problems with databases is that the experts, the subject matter experts, are typically incapable of actually working the data themselves. That's just not what they do, and so they need hands. And this has become a big problem that I have faced is, you know, how do you get the data, how do you become the in-between between the expert and the raw data that comes from the other side? And that's created a host of problems. One of the things, you know, Conrad and I are wrestling with is authentication of derivative information from an authenticated database. How do you authenticate that? under Federal Rule of Evidence Rule 1006. Is it a summary of voluminous materials? These are problems that have not been worked out. And I think one thing that's true, and it's certainly been my experience, I personally work a lot of the databases that I get. I don't get them idly, but a lot of databases I've seen produced in a lot of litigations never get used by anybody. It's just like an exercise. And what I can tell you is that in the litigations I am involved with, databases that are produced to us that my experts will rely upon, I very rarely see the opposing side's experts, and it's their data. I very rarely see them use the data that was produced. So I think fundamentally one of the problems with more production of more data is going to be more databases being used into trial, and I think there's a lot of work to be done on how to make that work effectively in some standardization or at least philosophical standardization, how to make that work effectively. That's something that will come over time.
Yeah, lawyers need to learn it. We can always punt to the next generation. But anyway, well, on that note, I just want to thank you guys. I know we went a little long on this, but I think it was well worth it. This was truly to some extent, a groundbreaking podcast that we've done at ESI Bytes. I'll recommend this to anyone that wants an example of the podcast series. I've enjoyed doing it. You guys have been very helpful and civil, and that's part of what we're advocating, so I appreciate it. For anyone that's listened to this at the end here, for a full list of podcasts, you can visit www.esibytes.com. You can search through, we've got a lot of material stored through the EDRM model, so you can find different topics and material. And we always say to visit ESI Bytes to learn about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. Thanks again, everyone, and have a good day.